My goodness, can that local oscillator get roaring back out that antenna port if that doubly balanced mixer, the very first mixer, isn't very well balanced. So what we used to think that, let me drop. We used to think that the early walkie-talkies and things like this that had a, what was it now called, super regen front end, which is a almost a kind of zero IF system, for a while, various people experimented with so-called zero IF systems, and they have very high dynamic range when they're done correctly. We used to think that was just a an old-fashioned technique. Well, that old-fashioned technique is coming back and becoming very popular. I suspect 98% of all the RFID readers these days are using a zero IF system. So it requires some special design techniques to meet FCC rules for local oscillator re-radiation, because you've got to be doing frequency hopping every millisecond or so across all of the channels between 902 and 928 megacycles in order to meet the requirements for that so-called license-free band. You've got a whole lot of cordless telephones, you've got a whole lot of RFID readers, you've got a whole lot of other things, remotely controllable devices using that so-called license-free band. The philosophy is that if each one of those emitting devices hops in frequency fast enough in a pseudo-random manner, where you're not quite sure what the next frequency is going to be, then the chances of these two services interfering with each other are drastically decreased. And so it's a kind of an adaptive system where everybody plays nice with each other, so to speak, and no one knows that the other service is using the same band at the same time. Let's see. I know that we got pretty far off of what John's original question was on dynamic range of receiver testing or transmitter testing, but still, receivers are something that Mel and I get a lot of mail on, because an awful lot of what goes on in the receiver is only partially understood. Let me pass it back to you, Mel, on this one. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, give it a good chance to clear here. Yeah, this is K2KEY. Yes, basically this is what a lot of the questions, so what does all this so-called, like you would say, jazz mean? And most of the equipment, of course, today is needing a let's put it this way, most of the transceivers you buy today are good equipment, and they will work well, and not to worry about every little nitty-bitty, DB and all these intricate measurements. You can put them side by side, but, don't overtake the piece of equipment. You know, if it's a few dBs different either way, that's it. It's not worth, owning. As far as, you can go on and on and talk about, all this business that has come up in the last few years, and all this reciprocal mixing and problems with oscillators and all, but it does take a lot of extensive work to keep those hard-on oscillators from, like you say, giving you grief, because you, I'm sure everybody, let me let it drop, has heard images, and many of these images is because they have been very liberal in permitting equipment to come into this country that has very little shielding, or not only radiates, but many times picks up things, and if, God forbid, if you're a ham living next door, you can have a lot of grief. So we sort of outgrew for a while the TBI situation, but it seems like it's rearing its ugly head and other forms as of lately, because of, like I say, the poor quality of a lot of equipment that's coming into this country. Okay, Dick, let's see, after 10, you want to go on with something else? Over.
PQJ follow-up.
Mr. PQJ, give me the full call and your name, and go right ahead with your follow-up, sir.
November 2, Papa, Quebec, Juliet. My name is Steve, and I want to follow up on the previous topic when you get a chance.
When you say previous subject, what was that one, Steve?
That was that antenna system off Route 135.
Go right ahead. Tell us what you know about that 135 antenna, Steve. Is it some kind of a marker beacon for the Republic Airport? Go ahead.
Well, I've always been interested on that antenna system every time I drive by. In fact, I'm amazed there's not more accidents over there by ham radio operators. I've often heard a non-directional beacon from Republic Airport, and the fact that someone associated the antenna system with that, I put two and two together, and let me let it drop. Using worldaerodata.com and Google Earth, I could give you the frequency that's being transmitted from that site. It's 407 kilohertz AM, and you'll hear a CW identifier of FR, Foxtrot Romeo, at 10 words per minute. Back to you, Dick, K2RIW from N2PQJ.
Fantastic, 407 kilohertz. Now, I'm reasonably sure that that wire that's suspended is nowhere near long enough to be resonant at 407 kilohertz. That would be many thousands of feet long. That's less than half a megacycle. That's the one megacycle would be 300 meters of wavelength. Half a megacycle would be 600 meters. We're talking about half a mile here for the wavelength. So that wire is nowhere near long enough to do that. Therefore, I'm beginning to think it's probably a top hat loaded monopole-like antenna, somewhat similar to what's used to listen to that Alexanderson alternator type thing. So is that your guess also, Steve, as to what that antenna is?
Oh, I'll have to leave the antenna ideas to you, but I can, like I said, I can give you the frequency, and we'll have to decide what it is. It's a pretty wicked looking array, that's for sure.
And there is another red antenna on the ground in that area, which looks a little bit like a corner reflector aimed up in the air, running at a much higher frequency. And so I'm going to have to look at some calibrated pictures of that to figure out what's going on that one. Okay, thank you for that information. One other thing I wanted to mention to people.
AC2AZ. Yeah, I got some email about the alternator stick.
Hey, Bob is back. Bob has got a beautiful puzzle for us. Let's pick up Mel on the Alexanderson alternator, and then we're going to pick up AC2AZ. He's got this great puzzle for you guys. Mel first, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I got a few emails that people are interested. I was once there. I visited. I took the tour of the Grimeton, G-R-I-M-E-T-O-N, Grimeton Suite. Anderson was designed by Ernst Anderson. He designed it. The alternators were built both by GE and RCA. In fact, I believe they had one once out on Long Island operating. 18,000 meters. That's 16.7 kilohertz, generated 200 kW of power. There were six towers, I remember. And wasn't there six towers? Wait, I'm asking my wife. You don't remember. Don't you remember standing or looking for them? No, not interested. There were six towers. They were about 127 meters high. They were spaced, I think I remember saying they were spaced 380 meters apart, and at the top of each tower, they had this big T-bar that called the T-arm, and it carried, they were 50 meters long, the T-arm. Let me let it drop. And they carried, each one had 12 wires coming down, as sort of like vertical wires dropping down, feeding the system. So it was quite a piece of quite an installation. And they do turn it on, I believe, once a year. It's still turned on, Vic. But it was something to behold. Over.
Yes, and Steve Barreras has done some receiving during those times that they turn on that that alternator system. What was that originally used for, to your knowledge, Mel? Was that ship-to-shore or shore-to-ship communication, something along those lines? Go ahead.
Was to provide communications back here to Long Island, I believe. They were I think, transmitting messages, I guess, back and forth. I believe that was his original intent. Oh, the call letters. I have the QSL card here. Here's the call letters. SAQ, Sierra Alpha Quebec. SAQ is their call letters. Was built. The system was built about 1920s, about 25, I believe, Dick. And I did visit some of these other, you mentioned the one with the submarine system and all. Let me let it drop, and I'll say a few words about that, and then we can go on. Okay, the submarine system, that was known as, we were in Hawaii at the time, we visited what was known as the ComSubPAC, Commanding Submarine Patrol during World War II. They used that with the gigantic Navy ELF system, and it was said that it could reach a submarine 400 feet under the ocean on 76 kilohertz. And this was quite a piece of, oh, to say the least, this was another huge piece of hardware. So they called it the ELF system, Dick, over.
And I once knew a person who worked on that so-called command receiver that operated on that system. And I think at one time in Jim Creek, Tennessee, there was a great big antenna strung between two mountains. Later on, there was the Project Sanguine antenna in the Michigan area, where the antenna was many miles of wire under a whole bunch of dairy farms.
Miles.
Say that again.
The wire was 50 miles long on the Sanguine project.
That's an antenna. 50 miles long. Reminds me a little bit of the very long interferometry arrays that are used for radio astronomy, where you'll have various sites in various countries, and you put the signal all together after you gather it from these various sites. Okay, Bob's with us, and he's got this beautiful puzzle. Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Zulu. Go right ahead, Bob. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick. I've just got to get my stopwatch going here. This is Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Zulu. I just wanted to add that antenna you said, I think I'm 135. I believe that corner reflector is a marker beacon antenna, which is pointed straight up. And somebody mentioned some wires on top. I thought those wires looked like telephone pole wires. You know, just some wires strung cross-insulated across the top. I have the impression that the grounding system to protect from lightning strikes, but the antenna at the bottom, the little orange thing, I believe is a marker beacon antenna pointed straight up, and that's, oh boy, I can't remember what the frequencies were. I think they were maybe 220 megahertz, maybe 329 in that area is the glide slope frequencies, but I believe that's what those were.
UGS.
108.5, 108.
Okay, Bill, you're a little bit noisy, but give us your information, QGZ. Go ahead.
All right.
Maybe Bill's not there right now. The puzzle that Bob's got is that he had this rather beautiful operating, I think it was a 40-meter dipole, but the wire for the dipole fatigued and gave him a mechanical failure. And he did, if you look at his photographs, he did a beautiful job of using stranded stainless steel wire. Looks to me like it's something like 3/16, 8 inch, 3/16 diameter, something like that, stainless steel multi-strand wire. And with beautiful swage fittings, compression fittings, he replaced the copper wire with stainless steel wire. And we did that is a beautiful 2 kilowatt rated 10-tech antenna tuner no longer would hit resonance. He could operate all the dials all he wanted to. He could no longer get a standing wave ratio dip on the antenna tuner. And so this was quite a mystery when it first occurred. I'm going to pass it over to Bob. You might want to add something to it. And then I'm going to pass it over to you guys to tell me what you would do to analyze the situation to find out what's going on or what do you think was happening. But before we do that, let me pass it over to Bob. AC2AZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. AC2AZ. Yeah, you know, I thought I had a problem someplace with the tuner, and I started playing around, and, you know, I would take the tuner out of the circuit, and all of a sudden it would work. I would take the linear out, and it would work. Put it back together, it wouldn't work. Did all sorts of things trying to figure out what it was and localize it. Then I figured, okay, it's the antenna. The antenna's bad. And then went to, I don't know if anybody's familiar with 4NEC 2X. It's a freeware antenna program. Modeled it, and that convinced me that the stainless steel wire really didn't affect it that much, even though I measured 12 ohms end-to-end just on one half of the dipole. So I went back to the whole thing the next night and started playing again. I figured, okay, let me bring this antenna wire, and I'm going to hook up a directional coupler to this thing and try and actually measure the return voltage. And at 7 megahertz, it shouldn't be too hard of a problem. Dropping. So when I did that, this is a little jumper that I had, a BNC jumper from inside the house to the outside to match to the new antenna wire I had going out to the dipole. I eliminated that one piece and brought the new wire directly into the house, stretched a little bit, got it to reach. And then I hooked it up, and wow, all of a sudden it worked. And then went back to the wire, and my fault. It was a bad connection to a PL259, didn't have the adapter, and over time the shield just kind of wore off and made it open. And it must have been the wind blowing on this thing, because occasionally the thing would work and start working, and then I thought I had an intermittent in the tuner, and that basically made me run around like a dog chasing his tail for quite a while. But eventually got solved. Now I eliminated that entire piece of bad wire, and it's running fine with back to the simulation dropping.
It looks like there's no beep, but did you finish, or do you want to give us some more on that one, Bob?
Yeah, just a little more. Went back to the simulation again to check that wire, and, you know, it was 12 ohms from one half of 51 feet. According to the simulation, with 100 watts in, I only lose a watt and a half, and I figured that was acceptable for an all-weather, robust stainless steel antenna. And the antenna was 16th-inch diameter, 7 strands of 7, so that's a 7x7 versus the old copper drawn wire, which was 7 strands, just plain 7 strands of number 22. Back to you.
Now, the lessons to be learned here is that we all should have realized this, that when he went to stainless steel wire, which we know that stainless steel has almost as much resistance as nichrome wire. I've run into some problems with stainless steel antennas that I've experimented with a few years ago at VHF, UHF frequencies, and gave us a lot of grief. And so when you measure with an ohmmeter, 12 ohms of resistance through the stainless steel wire, where the copper wire would probably measure a small fraction of 1 ohm, you can easily say, well, that's what you measure with an ohmmeter, but at RF frequencies and skin effect, the 12 ohms is going to be a lot higher. But you've got to be realistic. If the antenna at the center, when it's working correctly at the right altitude, has an impedance of, let's say, 72 ohms, and you add 12, or even if I want to be conservative with RF skin effect, 24 or 30 ohms of resistance, that's going to make some change to the standing wave ratio, but not night and day. If you guys were listening to my conversations with Bob 1 or 2 weeks ago, let me drop. I was coming up with all kinds of speculations of the lift wire problem with the strands of the stainless steel and the skin effect, and then he and I together thought that he might have had a failure of his antenna tuner. Either it's a switching network or it's relays inside that do the bypassing and do the flipping between it's an L-pad antenna tuner. You take a look at that Tintec antenna tuner. I think the model number is something like 238B. The thing is rated for 2 kilowatts. You look at the photograph of that thing, and it's the beefiest thing in the world. To take a passive network of a great big humongous inductor and a transmitter-rated capacitor rated for a 2-kilowatt rating, and I think the thing says that it can tolerate 10-to-1 standing wave ratio of any phase angle, and this thing will correct it. To get a failure in that box is extremely low in probability. And as I said, we went through all kinds of gyrations, say it could be this, it could be that, do this, do that test. Let me drop. The bottom line the lesson to be learned is in the beginning of your investigation, keep it simple. The simple ohm meter test, if the wire in the intermittent PL259 connector without the adapter on IG58 cable, if that hadn't failed at the wrong time, the ohm meter test would have revealed an open circuit, not just 12 ohms, if you know what I mean. A good visual inspection, but in order to do the visual inspection, if you got a rubber shrink tubing over the PL259, you might not know what's going on inside. You might have to carefully flex it, listen carefully, doing an ohm meter test while you're flexing and so on, but keep it simple. We were coming up with all kinds of complicated possible solutions, and I was starting to give Bob advice as to what to measure when you open up the cage of the 2-kilowatt antenna tuner to look for a bad rotary contact, a bad relay, or whatever, in order to get these characteristics that he got. Man alive, we were suspecting all kinds of things. A simple coax connector with intermittent contact, as I think as it entered his, as it exited his house and went up to the antenna, I think that's where the problem was. I was going to have you guys make guesses as to what it could possibly be, but Bob decided we're not going to go there. We're going to just tell you what the bottom line was. So he's now got a beautiful operating antenna with stainless steel, and because of the mechanical strength of the way he put it together, in theory, it's going to last a large number of years. Now back to you, Bob. AC2AZ, a good detective story. K2RIW in the TechNet.
AC2AZ, yeah, just to add to that, you know, I shorted the antenna here on the inside of the shack, went outside, and checked the whole antenna out. The current ball in at the bottom, I believe, is a ferrite type. It just, there's no windings in it. I can't measure anything across the windings, so I believe it might be a ferrite type. But when I did that, I measured the short out by the antenna. I removed the cable, measured the short, so I go, okay, I have continuity here, and I just kept on going back and forth, and this little stupid wire, every time it moved, it would work and then not work, and let me tell you, I feel pretty stupid after all of that, but I should never have let that bad coax connector get on the line. But so be it. AC2AZ.
How many times have you used the antenna once you got it all working well? And what kind of QSOs are you getting on a stainless steel 40-meter dipole, Bob? Go ahead.
I have not had a chance to do that. I just checked the SWR, and that seemed to be good. It is receiving quite well, so I'm assuming it's going to get out. The analysis shows I'm only going to lose a watt in the structure because of this change in stainless steel. I don't know. I'm hoping it's going to work fine.
This is another good example of the fact that what the human eye sees and what the RF sees are sometimes very, very different. You take a look at that very first transistor that was built in 1947 or 1948 at Bell Labs, a homely-looking piece of germanium with a couple of bent-up paper clips stabbing it. That was the first transistor, but it had gain, and it worked. And the RF energy going through that didn't know the difference, if you know what I mean. I've seen some really beautiful antennas, physically constructed to be very attractive, and yet don't work well because they weren't properly tuned, and vice versa. You take, for instance, the antenna that was used by Jansky in 1932 at Bell Labs, in order to measure the fact that the center of the universe is a big noise source. He had this great big Sturber curtain-like antenna on a set of rotary wheels, and he built it with pieces of mahogany wood that hold up the actual zigzag wire-like thing. And I think this whole antenna is about 50 feet wide, and it's a rotatable antenna. Maybe it's 80 feet wide. It's a pretty big thing. And I've seen people reconstruct that, where they made sure the mahogany was properly varnished, and it was a high-quality mahogany with a good glue joints and whatever. You can spend an awful lot of time making an antenna look beautiful, and if you don't understand the principles involved, it might not work, and vice versa. So there's more to it than first meets the eye. Let me drop it. I'm going to tell you something new. For those who watch PBS television, Bill Moyers had a beautiful conference that was on over the last couple of days, in which he interviews FCC Chairman Michael J. Copps, C-O-P-P-S. And Michael J. Copps, during that interview, told you about some of the things that are troubling him, about all of the systems, and he's trying to put some of that regulation capability back in. But one of the great requirements of the FCC is that every American citizen in the next few years must have broadband internet capability of 100 megacycles of downlink
connected
capability.
J4JCP link.
So there's a whole lot of people in the United States that are not connected right now by internet, either because they live in a very rural area or can't afford it. He wants every American citizen to have 100 megacycle downlink capability, which is a pretty broad bandwidth if you think about it. He also wants to stop some of the things that are going on that displease him, where certain internet suppliers, vendors, are treating some of their customers better than others. For the people who pay more money, they get greater bandwidth, and other people are being cheated, so to speak, and he wants that to stop. But one of the things that he's enacting for a new set of rules is that he wants the siting of cell sites to be done in a more expeditious manner. He wants there to be a ruling saying that a municipality that waits more than 90 days to grant the license for cell site installation must show cause as to why they're doing that. He doesn't, as it is right now, each cell site company has to set aside something like a quarter of a million or a half a million dollars, let me drop, in order to handle all of the legal wrangling that's required with local municipalities in order to get permission to put up a cell site. He wants that to stop. One of the things that he said during that Bill Moyers interview, which is a very interesting set of words, he says, any human being is entitled to have their own opinion. We're all entitled to have any opinion. We are not entitled to have our own facts. Have any opinion you want. You're not allowed to have your own facts. And people are coming up with all kinds of pseudo-facts when it comes to the apparent grief that can be created by a cell site, radio frequency biohazard, and the aesthetic displeasure and whatever. Lots of people are making up facts when it comes to that situation. So he is passing some brand new rulings to make sure that that doesn't happen. That's going to have an impact on the situation going on in the can't think of the name of the town. Bayville, Long Island. Bayville, Long Island is running three simultaneous lawsuits trying to remove all antennas from that town. And the information that's required, in order for a person to have the required information to make a rational decision, you must be able to review the facts of the situation. Let me drop. The taxpayer money in the town, in the village of Bayville, supported the organization that did the Park Report. In other words, a outside consulting agency came in and made a whole lot of measurements. And the measurements were made and published on the village website so that a person could read that report that they paid for, that measured all of the RF energy coming out of all the antennas in that town and rated whether or not they're safe or unsafe for human beings. And of course the answer was they came out extremely safe. A person needs that information in order to make a rational decision as to whether or not they should support these three simultaneous lawsuits to remove all the antennas. Well, all of a sudden, that information is not on the website. By the way, I read that 50-page report, approximately 50-page report, very well written, very well documented. It had one problem. It didn't put it, the results of all their measurements were not put in easy, understandable English language by non-technical people. But the village website supplied that information. There were four or five other documents that explained the terms and explained what radio frequency biohazard is and where the threshold of grief is and what is. There used to be a whole lot of other documents explaining all of that. All of a sudden, let me drop. All of a sudden, all of those documents are removed from the website of the village. So in other words, you need information to make a rational decision. The information is no longer available. That's taxation without representation. The people paid for that report. They paid for the documents, so to speak, that allow you to explain it all so you can understand it, and all of a sudden they're not there. And when people call the village and say, how come it's not there, they're not getting an answer. I'm a little bit afraid that the attorneys have said that this is biasing information. When it comes to an attorney telling you don't talk to the media because you're likely to be misquoted, I can understand that. But to take well-documented information and make it unavailable to the people that have to make the decision, to deny them the raw information to make a decision, there's some kind of a crime going on there in my mind. I wish we could find out what's happening. I'm a little bit afraid that with the recent FCC rulings about cell site siting, where it's going to become easier and easier for cell sites, which is going to make these lawsuits more and more difficult.
KC2SGI. Connected. KC2SGI.
It's going to make it more and more difficult connected to carry on these lawsuits. As I see it,
connected.
More and more money is going to be spent. More and more anguish is going to take place. And the chances of it turning out to be desirable are not very likely. So I wish there was an easy solution to this one. We have to slowly convince our friends and neighbors that live in the village of Bayville, Long Island, that radio is their friend, it's not their enemy. And that to deny the citizens the raw information by which they can make a rational decision, to me, is a crime. Okay.
Dick.
Hey, go ahead.
Pick up this guy that's breaking in.
Okay. KB2SGI, I think it is. Give us your name, sir, and go right ahead. My name is Dick. Eric, did I get the call letters wrong? Eric, what are the call letters, and how should we call this guy?
I think you got the call letters right. Let me see. Hang on a second. Q2IWKQJ. By the way, Mr. Copps is quite an interesting guy. I had a number of conversations with him in person. And I've got a copy of that. By the way, that's the second to the last Dome Warriors show. He's retiring after this. So, give me a second while I find out. The concept that we have here is that when you hear that stuff, that somebody's typing the word break, and in theory, they should be listening. KC2SGI, Kilowatt Charlie 2, Sugar George India. Right. He's supposed to, when he types break, he's supposed to let us know that he wants to speak, but maybe there's something wrong, but let's give him a shot anyway.
Those call letters are a man named Brian from Hop Hog, Kilo Charlie 2 SGI. Brian and Hop Hog, do you want to say something? Go right ahead. My name is Dick.
All right, I'll tell you what, Brian, why don't you type, because I see it says here that you have no mic, and I'll read it off to Dick.
By the way, these rulings of the recent changes of the FCC giving citizens, he wants all citizens to have 100 megacycles of internet bandwidth capability. It's going to make all kinds of changes of our rate of progress. United States, you could say, invented the internet. All of a sudden, when it comes to the amount of penetration of the internet in our population worldwide, we started off as number 2, we're now number 15. People in places like Korea and Japan and whatever have a hell of a lot more penetration of the internet to the general population than we do. That's got to change. And for people to say they're going to eliminate all the antennas from a town is in the wrong direction. You can read many of these details in the latest issue of High Frequency Electronics, the April 2010 issue, on page 24. Called News Update, Regulatory and Standard Activities. And the FCC is making a lot of changes, and apparently Michael Kopp is strongly involved in that. But I was really struck by that statement of his, that anyone's allowed to have a personal opinion, but you're not allowed to make up personal facts. When it comes to a situation, you got to make sure that what you're talking about is reasonable, and that you've got the raw information to make a decision. And so there's a lot of unreasonableness taking place in certain communities, as I see it. K2LIW listening.
Hi, Dick. KC2SGI says, yeah, sorry, I just downloaded the program and getting used to it. I am so sorry. So there we go. All right, continue onward. And most of the places that have higher internet penetration, like France and Britain, and Germany and a few other places that are well above us. We have more square miles than they do. They have higher densities in terms of what's connected. And take France, for example. Their telecom has been light years ahead of us. So, you know, there's different situations. Whereas if you go by the number of people in a given square area, Europe beats the South by a long shot because they're all clustered together. K2RW, K2J.
According to this article, Michael Kopp is going to be there until June 30th, 2010, when he, I think, automatically becomes retired. The previous FCC commissioners were Michael Powell and Kevin Martin. And I get the impression now that some of the relaxations of regulatory capability of the FCC, where the tiger became a lot more toothless, took place under Mr. Powell and Mr. Martin. And I think Mr. Kopp is going to try to correct some of that, because some more regulation is definitely required. He wants the Internet to be considered real telecommunications. That's what it really is. I mean, nowadays,
Let me just interrupt you for a second. One of the things that he stressed was is that they changed from communication technology, which was classified as a form of communication, to information technology. And the fact that they changed the classification moved it into a whole different segment of law. Go ahead, Dick.
And that whole segment of law now became much more difficult to regulate. It really got taken away from their regulatory capability. And that's aggravating some of these situations, as I see it. He wants to correct an awful lot of that. The difference between Internet and telephone these days is becoming very fuzzy. I think the FCC definitely had jurisdiction over wireless communication. I think they had some jurisdiction over telecommunications by way of telephones. I think for reasons I don't understand, they had very little control over what took place over cable television. Well, all of a sudden, cable television is becoming our telephone, our Internet. It's becoming everything. And in many communities, it does require regulation of some kind.
You know, that's not entirely true.
Okay. You've had quite a few conferences with Mr. Kopp. Tell us what it was like, what he said, and what he intends to do. You've got the floor, Eric. K2LIW in the TechNet.
First of all, cable television is well regulated by the FCC. It's considered telecommunication. That's their mantra. The problem was is that broadband, or Internet and broadband, or information technology, during the Bush years, during the Michael Powell years, it was plucked away from telecommunication and put into its own class, which kind of gave the FCC a hands-off approach as far as the court was concerned. This last court ruling is based on where that classification is. It got moved from a place where it was controlled to a place where it's not controlled. The last actual court action by the Supreme Court in terms of the throttling that Comcast was doing, or the elimination of the concept of net neutrality, was based on this classification that had been moved in the past 8 years. It was there previously. The FCC has a whole big, huge set of rules concerning cable television in terms of must carry, technical aspects of it, how it must operate. There is almost as many rules in cable television as there is in broadcast over-the-air television. It's a different branch of the FCC that regulates that, but there are as many regulations in terms of the telecommunications aspect of it, just as there is another branch that deals with telecommunication and wireline communication, which is not just telephone. It also includes long-distance data communication, but because the Internet that was created by the Defense Department, it was actually DARPANET originally, got that whole segment moved out of their hands, and that's why the Supreme Court voted differently on it. Dick?
What's your prediction, Eric, as to what's going to happen? I think you're saying right now the Internet, because of this movement to a different classification, is essentially unregulated. Now, you could, if you were naive and if your name was Greenspan, would say that, well, Wall Street will completely regulate themselves. Don't worry. All the bad stuff will filter out automatically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mr. Greenspan is now admitting that that was an extremely naive decision. By the same token, we thought the Internet, the DARPANet as it used to be called, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, that's what DARPA stands for, created in the very beginning in order for contractors on the East Coast and the West Coast, I think one was MIT and the other was Stanford University. They wanted to transfer information back and forth rapidly. That's how the Internet really got created. All of a sudden, we realized that it's an extremely good communication channel by which the society can advance themselves in education and purchasing power and whatever very, very rapidly. So perhaps citizens denied that access because of improper regulation is really not so good. What's your prediction as to what COPS going to be able to do? Do you think he's going to be able to reestablish or establish proper regulation of the Internet? Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
Well, don't forget that Mr. COPS is only one commissioner of a bunch of them. Mr. Junikowski is he's an unknown quantity, okay, in a certain aspect. He was previously a lawyer for the FCC. I don't remember his whole history, but he also has commercial influences behind him. People like Comcast and AT&T and the others are kind of like rejoicing over this last ruling because it gives them the ability to control the traffic. In other words, they can say, oh, they're using a peer-to-peer service. We don't like that. We can block this particular site because we don't like the political words that might be there. Those are the dangers. I mean, there is a positive thing in terms of, you know, if you're doing file sharing and you're violating copyright, you know, that's their mantra to, well, we'll throttle those people out and they won't be able to steal copyright. And it also, in terms of their ability to say, well, you can't afford this much, so we're just going to give you dial-up service. I think a number of things are going to happen. First of all, Mr. Copps has been a very vocal voice in the FCC and sometimes gets overruled. One of his big things and one of the discussions that I've had with him was the final killing of the Communications Act and a few elements within it, where there was a thing that created equal time. I'm trying to think of the name of it now. There's a name for it. I've lost it. It'll come back to me. The fairness doctrine. Yeah, there we go.
Repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Okay, I timed that. They're going to see in the next 6 months, you'll see the Supreme Court change its face a little bit. You will see Junikowski push his national broadband program, which has already hit a couple of big walls because he wants to steal a lot of bandwidth from the broadcasters, and it's actually going to take an act of Congress to do that. So there's a huge fight brewing, and within the next couple of years, I think you're going to see some of this stuff get resolved. One of the things that nobody's really talking about is if you are going to operate on a commercial basis and the concept is to make money, you know, Topeka, Kansas may be a city of, you know, 500,000. Go 10 miles outside of the city and there's nothing for miles and miles and maybe a farmer every 10 or 12 miles. Who's going to pay for that? How are you going to have that kind of connectivity? When we talk about bandwidth and broadband, we're really talking about population centers, whereas a vast majority of the country is a lot of blank space. And, you know, we think of Wi-Fi the way we think of it. It's 5 milliwatts, it's 10 milliwatts, you know, it goes 2,000 feet. Hello. So, you know, over-the-air broadband is like, okay, in a big city, maybe. Are we going to be putting 10 or 15-watt transmitters inside a computer? I don't think so. K2IW, K2IW.
I see where you're getting down to the facts of the way the population is distributed, particularly in rural areas. And I worry about the guy living in Idaho and Montana in the on a ranch farm, you know, a cattle ranch of some kind. How is he going to get connectivity? Who's going to pay for it? There's no ideal solution to that. You're telling me that the Wi-Fi cannot do it, wired cannot do it, because there's so darn many miles in between the individual nodes, so to speak, that it's going to be extremely expensive. If the guy's got a telephone service in Utah or Wyoming or Montana, I guess he could have dial-up, but that's going to be awfully slow. There's no ideal solution for that, is there, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, if he's got a wired phone, he could have ADSL, but there's a limit to how far away the microwave station that he's connected to is, because most of the rural wireline still use the terrestrial microwave to make their connectivity. There is a number of satellite services that give you broadband, but, you know, the cheapest one I've ever seen is like $69 or $70 a month. Until somebody comes up with something that's a lot cheaper than that, it won't be competitive, that's for sure.
If you take a country that claims to have very high citizen connectivity to the Internet, Japan or Korea or France, for instance, what do you believe that they are paying per month for their connectivity? The article I read suggests that the United States is 15th when it comes to world connectivity, but we're right in the middle when it comes to cost. So these countries with high connectivity, are they also averaging something like $60 a month, do you think, Eric, go ahead?
Well, my friends in France, they pay like $15 a month. My friends in Germany pay like $20 a month. And my friends in England, a little more expensive there, they pay $22 a month. That's the equivalent in U.S. dollars.
Wow. What do you believe a person in Korea or Japan might be paying? Go ahead.
I actually have no idea what they pay in Korea, but I know what they pay in Japan at 22,000 yen, or about $22.
Any idea what a person in Australia pays or a person in South America? Over to you, Eric.
I don't have any friends there, so I couldn't tell you.
KC2EBG.
Mr. EBG, it sound like you said KC2EBG. Correct me on the call letters. Please give me your name, and if you've got some information, go right ahead. We'd like to hear it. My name is Dick, K2RIW.
Okay, the call here is KC2UBG. And here is Joe. And in Japan, they actually have a different service. They pay for each megabyte, which is different from what we have, which is called an all-you-can-eat, an unlimited, so-called unlimited. They pay by the megabit, and it is used either through the cell service or through the wire connection in the house, and that's how it usually goes.
Good information, Joe. So they pay by the megabit. What do you believe the average citizen is paying? I had the impression that the average teenager in Japan does a whole lot of instant messaging and text messaging and so on, and they quite often gather at particular malls and all meet each other. What do you believe the average citizen might be paying for their rate of connectivity? Over to you, Joe.
Probably around $12. Heavy users, and this is why it's very popular there, because some people use it heavily and some people can use it less. It's like your water bill, you know, or your electric bill. You pay more, you use more electricity, you pay less electricity. There's, about 2 years ago, they had put up a new satellite that was for broadband use in China and Japan, and it was supposed to be a big new broadband service that would allow satellite service that would be much faster and much cheaper for people in China and Japan.
Does sound like we're not getting quite as much service, and we're paying a little higher. And I wonder if some of that, because of a lack of regulation, is the law of supply and demand not quite working right here? It seems like we're getting a little less for our money and paying a little more for it. Or am I being a little pessimistic here, Eric? Over to you, Eric. K2LIW from the TechNet.
Over there, the government supported. It's government subsidized in those countries.
Okay, well, the guys that I know are in business, and I know what they pay for their business stuff. I'm just looking on Google here, and the cost of broadband in terms of Japan seems to be the cheapest based on download speeds and megabits. So, I only know what I know, so I really couldn't really comment on what the individual does, other than I know that when I was over there a number of times, you know, I got my broadband service from Vodafone, which is, you know, it's a metered service, so it's really cheap.
Okay, make some guesses, Eric. We're not going to hold you to it. If I had a crystal ball and I could look 5 years ahead, am I going to have more download speed for less dollars? It seems like we're moving in that direction, but we're not moving as fast as some other countries. But maybe it's because we're spread out over a lot of square miles, and maybe that's the way it should be. Got any guesses as to what we'll be seeing in 5 years? Over to you, Eric.
No, that really kind of depends upon what the Supreme Court does, and there's still a couple of cases that are coming to be heard. I don't know if you're aware that Comcast really wants to put a cap on usage. They want to start charging, I don't remember what the number is, but after like 2 gigabytes or 10 gigabytes, I forget what the number is, then they want to start charging like, you know, $1 a gigabyte or $2 a gigabyte, something like that. So based upon that model, the more data you use, the more it's going to cost you. AT&T hasn't said anything like that to my knowledge, and a few other places. They want to do similar things. I know, like in India, what was it that I heard? They usually get like 2 megabits of download speed, and they pay something like a bit more expensive than what we pay here. I know in South America, some countries they pay a heck of a lot more, and it's needed, and in a couple of other countries they pay a lot less, and it's not needed. So, you know, what happens in this country is yet to be determined. If the FCC has its way and actually regains control of it, I think we can all be saved in terms of giving the telecoms more money than we really need to.
KAC2UBG for a comment.
Yeah, John recognized him. I have a quick question for Mel, I mean for Eric, and then I'm going to go over to Joe, and that is, back in the days of Ma Bell, we did have what we now know as a kind of monopoly, and when the FCC, I think it was, broke up Ma Bell and we had a whole bunch of baby bells, all of a sudden telephone service did become cheaper and buying telephones became easier. I had the impression that Comcast is close to a monopoly or has an awful lot of control in the United States. If the FCC gets its way, are they going to be doing a greater amount of regulation of Comcast, and will there be more competition by which the general person starts benefiting a little more? What's your guess on this one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, well, there's a notice of rulemaking about the a la carte for both cable and satellite, and the cable and satellite organizations are 100% against that whole concept. So, you know, where the government sticks its foot into the thing can have an effect. Comcast is actually the largest cable company next to Cablevision Systems and Time Warner. And you talk to anybody who has Comcast, and they absolutely hate their service. And it seems to be one of the most expensive ones around. So, because the concept of franchise, in the beginning, when cable occurred, you had to get a franchise from your community or from the county or from the town, and you pay a license fee for each telephone pole that you were on, and you were guaranteed no competition. In certain megalopolis areas, like New York City, you can choose from, say, Time Warner and RCN. RCN actually is Rogers Cable out of Canada. On Long Island, you have Cablevision and no satellite. So the fact is that the consumer really doesn't have much of a choice, and they're kind of like caged in. Whatever you're going to pay is what you're going to pay. And a company like Comcast can raise their rates and raise their rates and apply for a rate increase. And actually, the Public Service Commission of that state or that locality is going to either approve or disapprove of it. So where do you go?
There's one thing I don't understand here, Eric. Why does a community allow a franchise for only one particular service? If they were allowed two or three services in the community, the individual resident could then have some choice and there's some competition. Because the community chooses only one and locks into that one, and then some number of months or years downrange, that one realizes they've got a monopoly and they start doing things that are less than desirable. How in the world does a community get talked into that? How do they get cornered into that as opposed to accepting more than one service?
It's all about money, Dick.
It's payoff.
Okay. So I think you're telling me that there's a cash flow to some influential person in that community, and that's how it happens?
It's so political, it's unbelievable.
There's got to be ways of regulating that. Or are we gonna keep doing business as usual? Over to you, Eric.
KC2QIQ.
Just let me tell you that when I used to work for a guy by the name of Jim Nishimura when I was 18, most people don't realize that cable television kind of started by this Chinaman in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. These were all ex a company called Gerald that became gobbled up by General Instrument that got gobbled up by Motorola. They all had worked for this company that manufactured this stuff. And these guys were engineers and started these, including Dolan's, with Cablevision. They started these cable companies. And the way it started, and it goes even back to Irving Kahn and Teleprompter and Manhattan Cable and the fight that they had. Who could give the city or the locality the most bang for their buck? And that's how it did. And that's how it started. And the methodology became, you let us put our system in, we give you money, and you guarantee us that we have, that nobody else comes in and shares the polls. We make a special deal with the phone company. We make a special deal with the electric company, and ta-da. If you got no polls to be leased, you can't put anything in because the right-of-way was owned by the phone company. The right-of-way was owned by the electric company. Things have changed in many localities because the electric company is no longer a public company. It's a private company. So now things are a little bit different. That's why, like in New York where I am, I have two cable services I can choose from. Two. Not three, not four, just two. K2RW, K2J.
I get the impression there's a lot more to this. And I'm eventually going to find out if you feel like telling us what poor Mr. Jim Nishimura had to pay in order to get that privilege when he had it there for a while in Huntington. All right, we got John and Glenn in that order. KC2 UBG, I think it's John. or Joe, KB2 UBG. You know who you are. Go ahead, K2RIW, listening. My name is Dick.
And Tulio, put me on the list, Dick.
Roger.
Okay, I wanted to wait for the beep. KC2 UBG, name here is Joe. Okay, you know, in the next couple of years, there is going to be a big difference, and that is with WiMAX and LTE, which is a form of broadband wireless connection that is serviced by the phone companies like AT&T, Sprint, your cell phone company. Now you're going to have comparisons from your cable company to Optimum, to Sprint, and you'll be able to use your Sprint phone or a modem, which then converts the WiMAX into Wi-Fi into your local house. And this portable setup is already being used in some states right now.
For Very nice picture of you, by the way, on QIZ.com. I can tell you're a guitar player. Thank you for that information. Glenn, KC2 QIQ, go right ahead.
Yeah, good evening, Dick.